I'm Mink Smith, and I am a fine art photographer. I also paint and do mixed media dance and some short films. It astonishes me that I didn't really understand, even though I lived in Jim Crow, that there weren't that many images at all. I remember Jet Magazine, which was like a dime or something like that. And then they had a pretty girl in the middle of the centerfold that people would look at that every month. But especially like to see a black woman in a magazine, I guess you would say that would be pretty sexy, right? For, those times. But my father, he was an avid photographer, but he also painted and he sculpted. And I also became aware at a young age of all the very negative images. Life magazine sometimes had stories, which was a big thing. I remember once they had Dorothy Dandridge. And then I remember parts of Gordon Parks when they went south. But on a whole, media, I was not drawn to at all. It was just facts and who was against who, but not really the humanity. So when I came to New York, that's one of the reasons I think why I was drawn to Kumangi, because they showed the humanity, the beauty, the love for each other. And that was so important to me. I just thought they were just very good people. They had values and they had principles. And I loved that about them. And they were sincere. And they were all really good photographers by their own right. Each one was unique. Each one was different, but they loved the images. And it wasn't just images. They wanted photography, their work to represent high art as well. It wasn't just, oh, a black face. No, there was a real respect for the art form.
Welcome back to the Black Photojournalism Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitaker. For our final episode, we're heading to New York City with five different photographers, four of whom essentially came of age as artists together, as part of the legendary black photography collective, the Kumangi Workshop, which was founded in 1963 and still endures. You just heard from Ming Smith, who was the first woman to join the group, and later the first black female photographer to have her work acquired by the Museum of Modern Art. Ming hit on something key here. To this point, so many of the black photojournalists we've talked about, and in some cases talked to, aspired primarily to make a living and to do right by their communities. They wanted to document a fuller picture of black American life than they were seeing in the white-owned mainstream news. And they wanted to do so beautifully. But they probably wouldn't have imagined their work on the walls of a museum. The artists we're going to talk to in our final episode here followed in their footsteps and certainly shared their aspirations when it came to documenting a much fuller picture of black life. But as Ming said, they aspired toward high art in their work too. In so doing, they make a case for yet another critical lens through which we can consider this work. Work that was more than a record of a people and a place. Work that embodied subjectivity, creativity, and aspiration in and of itself.
My name is Adja Cowens. I'm a painter, photographer. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and I studied photography at Ohio University. I never thought about being an artist. That was actually the furthest thing from my mind. I was a musician. I studied music from the time I was in junior high school. My uncle gave me a Z-flat trumpet, so I played trumpet for years. But, I wanted to play in a jazz band. That was my idea when I grew up. I didn't think about being an artist until many, many years later in New York. My father was a butler, and our neighbors next door, they worked in the factory. And most of the people worked in factories and were everyday kind of people. I would say working people with middle-class ideas. They wanted to better themselves. People saved their money to try and do things, take vacations, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I grew up in the Second World War, the end of the Second World War. So there were a lot of photographs about, the Germans and the Japanese and, you know, stories about famous people, you know, movie stars. I think Life Magazine, Post Magazine, all the magazines that were being done at that time. Of course, we couldn't actually afford, you know, comic books and magazines. But where my father worked, that family got the magazines and we would get them secondhand. So these were the magazines that had photographs in them. But I was also a paper boy. So I knew a lot of things were going on in the world because I carried the day paper and the evening paper. I remember seeing pictures of black people being hung down south. It's frightened me, you know. And I never wanted to go south, even to this day. My mother was an avid picture taker and an amateur photographer. So she had all these books, it must have been about 8 or 10 books filled with pictures that she started collecting when she was about 16 years old. Pictures of, you know, the new babies and their family, pets, picnics, cousins, aunts, uncles, everybody. She had all these photographs. And on days when it was raining, you know, I would look through these books and I used to think about who these people were. I realized that a photograph was very real to me because I could see my past relationships. And then my sister's boyfriend had one of the few magazines of photography at that time. And it said in the magazine, Ohio University gives degree in photography. So I showed it to my mother. I said, Mom, look, I can study. She said, well, that's fine, but, you know, wait till your father comes home, you know. So my father came home. I said, well, I want to go to OU and study photography. He said, what's wrong with you, boy? Are you crazy? He said, Kodak makes a camera. You put the film in it. You shoot the pictures. You send it back to him. He said, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, but this is like a college course. He said, that's ridiculous. Photography is a hobby. It's not life's work. So my mother said, but honey, that's what he wants to do. So I went to Ohio University, 1954, that fall, to study photography. And of course, I did what most students do, a party. Oh, yeah. I'm in college. I'm away from home. Girls, you know, wow, yay. Second year, yay. Third year, I said, you better get serious. My junior year, I started taking pictures in my town there where I lived in Columbus. And I shot a picture of these little kids holding balloons. They were on Mount Vernon Avenue. And my grandmother's church was right there on that corner. And it was what people said about the photograph that made me more interested in being a photographer. Because for me, it was a way into their heads. When people talked, that was kind of cheap psychology, sort of. And I like that. I like that I could show a photograph to somebody and they would tell me how they felt about it. But it was always from their point of view. But anyway, that junior year, I got serious. My uncle said, why don't you find somebody colored that's doing what you want to do? I said, all my teachers are white. I don't know. He said, well, ask one of your teachers. So I asked Walter B. Allen, because he seemed to be the hippest of the teachers. He lived in New York, so I thought he was cool. So he said, there's a guy, a black man at Life Magazine. I think this was 1955. And they published a book of Life Magazine photographers. And on the back, there was a picture of Gordon.
Gordon being Gordon Parks, widely considered to be one of the greatest photographers of the 20th century. He first made a name for himself taking pictures for the Farm Security Administration in the 1940s, having been inspired by other FSA photographers' Depression-era work. In 1948, he became the first black staff photographer at Life magazine, where his subjects range from black power to high fashion, Harlem gangs to Barbra Streisand. He eventually made movies, too, most famously, the original Shaft. But let's get back to Adger.
So I wrote him a letter and told him I was a student at OU and studied photography. And so he said, well, call me, you know. And we used to come to New York all the time to hear Thelonious Monk at the Five Spot, or if Miles was at Carnegie Hall. So we would pal in the cars and we would drive to New York. And so when I came to New York, one of the times I called Gordon. He said, well, come up. And so I got on the train to White Plains, and I'm standing there waiting, and I see this powder blue Corvette with a white leather interior. Turn the corner, a black man with shades on and smoking a pipe. And I said, shit, this is, I'm going to be a photographer. And I got in the car and he took me to his house and talked about photography. And he said, well, get in contact with me when you get out of school. So when I did get out of school, I quit. I didn't graduate there. I just quit. And I decided I was just going to go to New York. And I got on the bus. I had $12. This is 1958. And so I got on the bus to New York and I checked into the Y on 34th Street. I called Gordon the next day. He said, where are you? I said, I'm at the Y. He said, come up here. I got on the train and went up there, and he met me, went to the house. He said, so what are you going to do? I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I just like taking pictures. He said, why don't you work with me at Life Magazine as my assistant and live with me and my family here? And that started the ball kind of rolling from there. And then I got very serious about what I was doing. I begin to see photography as a way of telling stories.
Adger assisted Gordon Parks over that summer of 1958, but had to pause his photography career when he was drafted into the Navy. He returned to New York, and to Harlem specifically, right after his service, and resumed taking pictures of
anything that moved me, people, abstract, anything that I felt something was happening. I shot pictures of snow, people walking down the street. I had a lot of pictures of Harlem, kids playing basketball, and the balls in the air, you know. And the color is not what makes the picture. It's the picture of people doing something that all people can relate to, you know. All people can relate to pain. All people can relate to joy, you know, tragedy. There are all those things that make us human. You know, and all those things are still in harm, but not in the same kind of way, because everything is always changing, you know.
Adger resists the notion that Gordon Parks taught him anything technical. He already knew how to make a good picture. Like Three Shadows, the now iconic black and white photograph, he took from a high vantage point of three young black women walking down a Bronx street, their shadows stretched across the sidewalk in the late afternoon sun, rendering them larger than life. But his experiences with Gordon were still enormously formative, and the two photographers were lifelong friends.
What I learned from Gordon Parks was how to take negative energy and turn it into positive power. That's what I learned from Gordon, because he went through all the racism you could think of, but he did not let that deter him from his work. It's all energy, he said, and it's what you decide to do with that energy. Put it into your work. Take that energy, that anger, pull it in and use that energy to do your work, do better, do, you know. And that's the lesson that I learned from Gordon. And that's the lessons I try to teach other people too.
It wasn't long before he had the opportunity to impart this wisdom to others.
I did a picture of Louis Armstrong, 1961, for Theater Magazine. And Ray Francis saw it.
Ray Francis, being another photographer of the era, who had just co-founded a collective of black photographers that would ultimately become the Camonge Workshop.
And he said, hey, man, why don't you come up here and help us? Because, you know, we're amateurs. We don't know what we're doing. So I came up. This is 1961. And I showed the guys, I took out a meter, and they said, what's that? I said, it's a light meter. They were all amateur photographers. But I was a professional photographer at that point. I was making a living from photography. Then I just kept going to meetings and telling guys more and more and teaching more and more. I started to critique. I said, critique the work, not the person. But of course, they didn't listen to me. We were meeting since 1961, very sporadically. And then we started meeting on Sundays, but there was no name for the group. And there were a lot of people who came in the group and left. They didn't want to be part of an all-black group or just didn't want to be part of a group. So it wasn't that everybody wanted to get in Camonge, but those that came that stuck it out because people wanted to learn. They came to those meetings excited to learn. There were no schools at that time for young black photographers that wanted to do photography. And that was one of the main reasons that we came together. The name Camonge is a Kikuyu word. It was brought to the Goot by Al Fanar,
another photographer and Kamange co-founder.
And so we decided to take that because it meant a group working together. And that's what we wanted to do. And the idea was if you wanted to be in Kamange, you had to submit a portfolio. And then the next week, they would come and they would be either voted into the group or not. And then we discuss everything, film, jazz, music, you know, we discuss all kinds of things. It wasn't just photography. We're concerned about the whole art. And I was always trying to teach the fact that photography is an art. You have to learn to see. I would give people assignments and people would bring work in and we critique it and we went back and forth. At one meeting, we got in a long discussion about the negative images that white people were publishing. You know, the media was always negative. It was nothing positive. And so we decided we would take that mantle up and shoot pictures, since we know our people better than they do, to begin to photograph positive images of Black people. And that's what we did, but also fine art. What became fine art, you know? Photography didn't become a fine art until Ansel Adams was on the cover of Time magazine.
This was in 1979, and what Adger means here is not a picture by Ansel Adams, but a picture of Ansel Adams on the cover of Time magazine, smiling as he holds his large format camera under the cover line, The Master Eye. The cover resulted in a surge of prices and recognition for Adams's prints, and for fine art photography on the whole.
Then limited editions came in. Then is the silver gelatin print. All these different things came in. But in those days,
meaning the early 1960s,
if people published your photograph in a magazine, they gave you $15 and no credit. That was another thing people fought for. Who are you? You're just a photographer. This is a story. It's important to the magazine. I mean, that's the reason I never really went to work for Life magazine. I worked with Gordon, but I never went to try to get a job there because Gordon told me, he said, Life magazine is interested in their point of view. You can photograph something, it might be really beautiful and sensitive, but they're going to publish what they want to publish of your work. He said, and the kind of works that you do, he said, I don't think you'd be happy working at Life magazine because your work is very good and it's very personal. He said, and I think that you should continue doing the work that you're doing and not try to work for a magazine. So I never did.
This is an important point about the founding and early members of the Kamange Workshop. They all did documentary photography and they sold images freelance. They shot for both local and national publications, newsprint, and glossy. But few of them would have called themselves photojournalists. Their intent was personal. They aspired toward high art. And more often than not, the mainstream media just didn't get it.
My name is Sean Walker. I am an educator, photographer. I'm a Harlem child. I was born in Harlem Hospital, and I spent, 26 years before I left Harlem? My uncle was a photographer, and he used to do photographs in bars and stuff like that. He'd give out a card and, you know, contact me and I could get you a print. So when Polaroid came out, I mean, he took to that like a duck to water. So I used to carry the film and the camera equipment around with him. So I was in and out of bars before I was even 16. And I went to high school for photography. But at some point, I was out in the street selling drugs. And I come from a middle-class family. It took me a while to realize that because of all the things that they said about Black folks at that time. I thought because my family didn't have a car and didn't have certain things like that that I saw on television that white families had, I thought I was, you know, a poor ghetto kid. And before going to jail officially, one of the members of Kamange Workshop came and said, listen, we're having a meeting. A group of Black photographers are going to get together. And would you like to come and see what's going on? And I understood that that was my lifeline. And if I didn't grab that, bad things were going to happen to me. So I came to the meeting, met with these guys, and just said, hey, this sounds like what I want to do. And that group turned into Kamange Workshop. Eventually, Roy DiCaraba came to meet the guys. And he said something to the group that I've never forgotten. He said that what you guys are trying to do is art. And it kind of blew my mind. You know, we looked in magazines growing up and we knew what that word meant. But to have someone say that this is what we were embarking on was really powerful and motivating. So that's how the Kumonge Workshop started, as far as I'm concerned.
My name is Anthony Barbosa, and I'm a photographer. When I was in the Boy Scouts, I was getting all these merit badges, but I looked at photography and said, oh, that's too difficult. I can't do that at home. And lo and behold, even though I thought that, I always walked home from school and stopped in a secondhand bookstore and looked at Life magazine, Look magazine, and liked looking at images. So one day I decided that I would go to New York because Adja Collins had known my aunt. So Adja brought me over to Kumonge meeting, and I didn't even have a camera. So lo and behold, in 1963, I got a little $15 camera, and I started taking photos. And I was living in a hotel in New York, and then all of a sudden, I was drafted in the Army, and I had to join the Navy. But what happens when I go into the Navy after boot camp? I was stationed in Pensacola, and that's where they had the photography school, but they gave me structural mechanic. In the town, they had an art fair outside, and I put up some photographs and won all these ribbons. So they decided that instead of being a structural mechanic, they put me in, and I started working for the station newspaper. But Kumonge was always on my mind, so I had to spend 3 years in the Navy and then get out. But I was photographing all the time down south, so it became a fascination with me all the way through. So even when I got out of the Navy, I said I didn't want to go and work on any of the jobs, so I'll just do any kind of photography as long as I had a camera in my hand. So I ended up doing advertising, fashion, everything, and also I made money to work on my own projects.
Here's Sean Walker again.
Once I got into Kumonge Workshop, I think it was Ray Francis said, hey, listen, HARYU Act was a program.
HARYU stood for Harlem Youth Opportunities Unlimited, an organization founded in 1962 by a pair of psychologists in close consultation with Harlem community leaders, ministers, and government officials. Its goal was to alleviate poverty, delinquency, and drug use in Harlem by creating educational and employment opportunities for the neighborhood's youth.
And one of the main centers was at the Teresa Hotel. So Ray said, hey, I know a woman that's working up there. You should go see, show your photography, see what's going on. And she saw the work and she said, oh, you should go up and be on the newspaper. So as a journalist, that was my first photographic job. And it was my learning school. Then I was sort of the guy that could roam the streets of Harlem and take pictures. So I'm earning a living as a photographer at this early stage. Some gentleman walked up to me and said, they told me you're the guy that takes pictures for HARYU Act. And I said, yes. He said, listen, I'm starting a newspaper. I'd like you to come aboard. So I was the only photographer on the paper called the Harlem Daily. So at 26, I'm working for two newspapers. So I really think I'm hot stuff. And what it did is it allowed me for a lot of entree into organizations, into people. And it was really the power of the camera was as important to me as it was to other people. Because you got to remember, at that time, Black folks weren't being photographed. They could not have photographed themselves. So we used to always have to go up to the arcade to do the machine where you could get that strip of photographs. That's the only way Black folks got pictures of themselves. So it was a point where people were just open. Yeah, take a picture of me. I don't care whether you give it to me or not. I just want to be photographed. Because assuming that I worked for something important like a newspaper.
Yet for both Sean and Anthony, Kumonge was primary.
I learned more from the group of photographers at Kumonge than any place else. And what I found out is that every one of the photographers in the group photographed because of a feeling they had about us as a people. And that was very important. When you feel something for your own people, then you learn to do that with anybody you photograph. I took those ideas, and when I went and go photograph other people for New York Times Magazine or Life Magazine that I worked for, for a short time, I always met the people and tried to photograph them from the feelings I had being with them. And that helped me a lot.
And Tony, we became family for even that short period of time. We became family.
Yeah.
And my learning, not only in photography, about art, about culture, I was made aware of that by being in the workshop.
Yeah, music, everything, yeah.
Right, and, you know, so we were all into jazz, so jazz was played at our meetings constantly. But the reason why we weren't considered ourselves journalists, because we were self-motivated because of our community and because of our culture, where journalists had to go shoot assignments. And the one thing I realized when I shot some of this, I remember the one shoot time, I was told, he said, listen, there's a shooting down in Harlem somewhere. Go down and get some pictures. I went down there with a writer. There was nothing happening. There was no sign. And there was a hole in the glass. And I called the office. He said, shoot the hole in the glass. We'll write a story around that result of the shooting. And I realized this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Sean has taken photographs throughout Harlem for more than 50 years. He's documented parades, storefronts, children, street scenes of joy, but also hardship. His searing photographic series, Drugs, ran in Essence magazine in 1970. Sean's work also took him around the world. He joined Third World Newsreel in 1965, where he did significant work in Cuba. He later did projects in Guyana, Nigeria, Senegal, and Mexico, too. In 2020, he became the first Black photographer to have his archive acquired by the Library of Congress.
You know, my family looked at my work, and we were getting ebony. I think it was ebony. And they would say, why aren't you shooting these upstanding Black people? You know, everybody with suits and stuff like that. And you're out here shooting people in the street. But I'm saying, hey, but this is a positive part of what we've learned from. My experiences has come from Harlem. I remember when I wanted to try to smoke cigarettes in my little crew, we had to go 4 or 5 blocks from our block to smoke a cigarette. And even then, a stranger could grab you and drag, take you, where you live at. I'm going to take you home to your family. And that point was that we understood that there was some pride in the way that people lived, that we wanted to show that part of us. You know, all of us have shot Easter Sundays. Easter Sundays was when we looked our best. And Black people felt that this is, if I don't do this any other day, Easter Sunday, I'm going to get some kind of a new outfit. And all we had to do as photographers is go up to 125th Street and photograph people with suits. And if you look at all of the old photographs done by Blacks and some newsreel stuff, that all Black men wore hats.
Mm-hmm.
My mother wouldn't let me out of the house without a hat. Where are you going? You ain't got no hat on. And we talked about that amongst each other because we all came from different places. And to talk about what we're going to do is set a standard of what our photographs are going to represent.
Well, I didn't want to do anything else but have a camera in my hand. So I opened up a studio, and believe it or not, the first job I got was for Esquire magazine. So it sort of got me in my grips to do anything I could to work on my projects. And the very first project I worked on was portraits in the studio of a lot of artists and musicians.
Artists and musicians like James Baldwin, Miles Davis, and Grace Jones.
And each person, I did not figure out anything until they came into the studio. And then I would create a lighting for them and do the photographs. And then I started thinking about different ideas, and there were things that popped up that reflected how I was feeling. And I realized now, after so many years, it is your subconscious that has you choosing what you do without thinking. Most photographers go out and they think too much. And I always think it's better to feel than to think. When you start thinking, the photographs look like that. You start posing people. You can't do that in the street. You're missing something. To me, even when Cartier-Bresson came out with Decisive Moment.
This was a book first published by the renowned French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson in 1952. It put forth Cartier-Bresson's ideas about documentary photography and how the documentarian must not only bear witness to events, but learn how to recognize the precise moment when their significance is expressed.
Well, that's like having a framework in your mind when you walk out the door, and you're always looking for that and you're missing other things. So this decisive moment didn't work for me either, because I wanted to be open-minded and see what's there and feel it. And I always incorporate that no matter what I was doing, even if it's in a studio, even if I'm doing fashion, which I did a lot too as well. You're feeling the models and feeling the clothes. You're not trying to pose them too much. Let them feel the clothes they're in, and they'll move the way they feel.
Now, I was in the decisive moment. That was my thing. I thought Cote Brisant and Rodrigo Robin, all those guys, I thought were the best. That I went out to try to freeze a moment that people were unconscious of. For me, that was the important thing, that trying to get people in a natural state. That's what I was trying to do. But one of the important things is that in Camoingé meetings, you had to bring photographs regularly. And you had to be criticized, but it was constructive criticism.
Yeah.
Right? So this is what was so important about the meetings. And now again, we met every Sunday for at least 3 or 4 hours. Then sometimes we would go out to lunch or dinner after the meeting. So it created problems with our family members. So girlfriends, wives, children, whatever. You know, it was, what are you doing at those meetings? But that's what was the fundamental grounding. So that was like going to class. We were all stuck on Rembrandt. I mean, hey, Rembrandt was a favorite thing that just sort of floated through the air. So I think for me, that was why the group was so important.
But that higher calling that Sean Walker, Anthony Barboza, Adger Cowens, and Ming Smith have all talked about remained essential. This idea of positivity, of uplift, of humanity, and of representation beyond the mainstream news.
Gordon Parks, you know, the 3 stories he did, I would not show to my students. Flavio in Brazil. I mean, these were people that were just really down and out, and it reflected how the world saw us as a people.
Yep.
And that was the one thing that we understood, that we were out there trying to do different. And the only thing that was different was that we were trying to do these uplifting photographs with technical quality. That was the thing that we were bringing to the table too. But I remember I had a photograph that I showed to Roy.
As in Roy De Carava, another remarkable photographer and artist, and Camoingé's first director.
A woman that lived in my building, and she had a humpback. I didn't photograph her for the humpback, I photographed her for the expression. But Roy would say, hey man, you know, we're always being portrayed with something wrong with us, and you should think more about whether you want to use this photograph or not. And we argued and fussed and did a whole bunch of stuff that we, you know, we did what families do.
We fight.
Right. Yeah, we did what families do. And that was a key point. When people came to the workshop, the one thing we did stress was quality in printing, quality in subject matter, and lack of commercialism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened in the workshop. And that's what became so important to us.
That feedback often came from Adger Cowens, too. And as Adger himself attests, he didn't hold back. But he had his reasons.
I was like, that's bullshit. Take it down. Well, don't embarrass us with this kind of work. You want to be a professional photographer and you come in here and you come with a lousy print that scratches and stuff. I was hard on everybody. And people would say, well, what I was trying to do, I said, take it down. Take it down, because if you tell me you are trying to do something, that means you didn't do it. So I don't want to listen to what you tried to do. I want to see what you did and the decisions that you made that make you think that this is a photograph that could last forever. Because to me, that's what art was. It had to do with, did you caption something that had a human essence from the heart that will remain relevant long after you're gone?
Adger, Ming, Sean, Anthony, and so many of their Camoingé peers continued to have success into the 1970s, 80s, and beyond. Their work is in the collection of major museums, and they show and sell their photographs with great galleries. Harlem, of course, has changed, but Camoingé continues as a collective, mentorship program, and academic endeavor, with Adger currently at the helm. Its members have worked collectively to publish books and put on exhibitions. In 2020, the group was also the subject of a major exhibition at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts and the Whitney Museum of American Art. Still, there was something singular that coalesced in those early years. As Adger Cowens puts it,
I think that we were a unique group because we were committed to the image. I mean, we went and bought film before we bought food and paid our rent. Film was more important than making images, more important than anything else. We were committed to the image because we realized that therein lies the truth of who you are as an artist and as a person.
We have one last New York story to share with you from Marilyn Nance, who followed in Camonghi's footsteps in a sense and counted founding member Buford Smith as a mentor. But I'll go ahead and let Marilyn introduce herself.
My name is Marilyn Nance, and I now call myself an artist. I started calling myself a photographer when I graduated from Pratt Institute. But I've always done a lot of things. I've done radio, television. I studied graphic design. And I think I'm an archivist by family trade. I don't know. My mom wasn't a collector, but she kept up with people. I started calling my collection the Marilyn Nance Archive. And people thought I was being kind of smug, like, you think you have an archive. But now archive is a sexy word. So everybody wants to have an archive. Everyone's talking about the archive, the archive, the archive. But we all have a legacy and we all have a collection. And I acknowledge that. I'm from the middle of the 20th century and I guess on to the turn of the century, like African-American woman. My mom subscribed to a lot of magazines, and so we looked at Life magazine. I think we subscribed to Look, and that was my introduction to photography and also to art. I think that we were influenced a lot also by television. My mom was from Birmingham, Alabama, and so we saw a lot of what was going on in Birmingham on TV, and it just didn't jive with what we knew about Birmingham, because when we think about Birmingham, we think about our uncles and cousins and grandmother and, you know, things like that. And then to see like hoses turned on people and dogs, I mean, that kind of affected us. I don't recall my mother actually, like her reaction, but I do know that the day of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church was also my mother's birthday. So that always kind of stuck in my head.
This, of course, was in September 1963, when four members of the Birmingham Ku Klux Klan bombed a local church, murdering four young girls. At 11 years old, the youngest, Carol Denise McNair, was just a year older than Marilyn was at the time.
So as children, we were pretty conscious of class and race and social position. And I think one of my interests in photographing was to show like what I knew. The way Black folks are represented is not the way I thought of Black folks, you know, because here I am. So the images I make tend to be joyful, quote, positive. I think that no matter what happens in the world, I'm trying to take a higher road or look for the good behind something, because it's like your diet. You are what you see. You are what you eat. You don't want to consume a lot of trash because it's bad for your health. So I guess that my photographs kind of aid in mental health. But then some of them were like so positive. People just did, especially when it came to like publications, it's like, this isn't Black life. Well, what do you know about Black life, you know? I think that every photograph I make is a self-portrait. Every photograph is something that I was thinking, I was seeing, and I wanted you to see it also. I don't know how that practice evolved, but I do know that I've been places where I've been with other photographers and we're pretty much in the same position, but we'd wind up with totally different photographs. Like in a press situation where there's an event that's in front of us, I was always doing something different. And one of the reasons is, you know, I'm short. And if I can't photograph like there, I'm going to find something else, because there's another way of telling the story that's not necessarily what's in front of you. I remember once during like the Dave outrage, there were meetings all over.
This action was in response to a racist attack that happened in December 1986, when a group of white teenagers set upon three black men whose car had broken down in Queens. One of those black men, Michael Griffith, was struck and killed on the Belt Parkway while fleeing the attack.
And there was a meeting at a community center, and one of my friends, a white photographer, was being put out of the meeting because they were white photographer, and this was only for the community and da-da-da-da. And I was like, well, you know, the opportunity then is to photograph yourself getting put out of the meeting, because sometimes we mistake what the story is. You know, we think that the story is what is presented to us, what's right in front of us, what the news says the story is, but the story is your experience of the moment. And so what I photograph is always my experience. They say that everything that sort of gets in your way is really just a redirection. So I don't get upset too much about a train that's stuck, or like there's always reasons why things happen or don't happen. For me, photography is a way of being. It's a way of exploring with permission. I'm just nosy too. I'm really nosy. And the camera's a good excuse to get into places and talk to people. Because if you want to see yourself in history, you have to show up and you have to make that history, because no one's looking for you. When you see groups of photographers, they're always white. They're usually men. They're always taller than me, right? So like, if you want to see yourself, you have to really make that happen. And if you want to make sure that your work is seen after you're gone, you have to also make that happen.
This idea of showing up is one that I have to imagine resonates with so many of the photographers we've talked to and about on this series. They showed up everywhere the community was and everywhere that the white-owned mainstream media wasn't. From Clinton Wright on the west side of Las Vegas to the Camonge Workshop in Harlem, to Bruce Talamon on the road with Jesse Jackson in 1984. For Marilyn Nance, showing up meant photographing young black girls playing double dutch on the streets of Brooklyn and documenting different kinds of black spiritual practices all across the United States. She was a longtime freelance photographer for the Village Voice, too. But in 1977, showing up meant traveling to Lagos, Nigeria, for an historic international black arts summit called FESTAC, which brought delegations from throughout the diaspora to Lagos for cultural events and exchange.
I used to like hang out at the Studio Museum in Harlem, and I'm sure there was a flyer or something about FESTAC. Everybody knew that this festival was happening, and the organizers of FESTAC 77, what became FESTAC 77, wanted regular people to come, cultural artists from the different communities. And so the word went out and we would talk about it, and any artist could apply and those who could go went. So I applied and I showed a portfolio of images, and my buddy Ajuba Douglas applied, and my work was accepted to be shown in the exhibition at FESTAC. And Ajuba's work was accepted to be shown in the exhibition. She had some design work. Both of us were on the young end, and so there were older artists who were well-known, like Camoinge were there, and Africobra, but there wasn't enough money for everyone to go. So they had to cut the list, and I was cut off the list. At the same time, Ajuba was cut off the list. So I was in a television production workshop, and I overheard two of the instructors talking about how FESTAC was looking for technicians to work the festival. And so I then wrote a letter to the FESTAC officials saying, listen, in light of the fact you didn't return my photograph, I think that when you're looking for technicians, please think of me like first. And so anyway, I got to go because of that letter, and also because I called like every day. I'm pretty persistent. So I got to go, and Ajuba got to go. I was listed on the manifest as a photo technician. And so once I got to Fest, once we got to Lagos, I mean, I saw the schedule and I made up my own itinerary. I self-assigned and I photographed what I wanted to do. And that's the story. I brought my own film, my own cameras. And, you know, matter of fact, I had rolls of 100 feet and I was bulk loading cassettes of film in the heat of Nigeria inside of a changing bag. So like, yeah, I paid my dues. So now you want to know what FESTEC is.
As widely known and anticipated as the summit was in the 1970s, FESTEC is, unfortunately, a lesser-known history today, which is another reason why Marilyn's photographs remain so important.
FESTEC was the second World Festival of Black and African Arts and Culture. And it is said that 17,000 artists were there. We all lived in like sort of an Olympic village called FESTEC Village. All the artists lived there. And I don't know how many thousands of people came to witness the, you know, performances and films and, you know, all kinds of things happened there.
As soon as Marilyn learned about FESTEC, there wasn't any doubt in her mind that she would attend.
I think I always had a sense of history. And that's how I self-assigned other things. It's like, oh, this is historic. I need to make sure that I get this.
A book on Marilyn's FESTEC work was published by Fourth Wall Books in 2022. It's called Last Day in Lagos, and it offers exactly the kind of experience she's described. FESTEC, but through her eyes, her lens, her point of view. We see different delegations on and off the field at the main stadium. We see locals gathering, watching, having a Coke, having a meal, just hanging out. We see street scenes, travel scenes, music, painting, sculpture, dance. Sun Ra and others rehearsing in FESTEC Village. Stevie Wonder and others taking the stage. But it was the quieter moments of exchange that Marilyn appreciated most.
The photographs, the moments that I really enjoyed were like sitting in the restaurants and meeting like other people, like sitting across from someone from Sudan or wherever, you know, like just talking to people. You know, these are people we saw in magazines or books, but and they saw Americans maybe in movies or something. And here we are, like sitting across the table from one another, trying to figure out like where everyone's happy to be there. It was like a great exchange. And I guess it really wasn't even about the luminaries. Like I'm flipping through too now just to see. I photographed a lot of photographers. I'm on like page 95 now.
This is an image from the FESTEC 77 opening ceremony. Young African men march in some sort of procession as young African women watch bedecked in beads.
And like the people in the foreground are like out of focus because that's how close I was to them. But I think I was just feeling a moment and just like making that image. Most of my images, if not all of my images, are photographs of people. You're looking at them. You can see the details in their face. You can read the humanity.
We asked Marilyn if she thought it was notable that she made these photographs and made this journey when she was only 23 years old. The answer was no.
Everyone talks about, oh, you were just 23, but like Martin Luther King Jr. was dead at 39, so he did a lot of things at 23. Young people do stuff.
But Marilyn also looks at that passage of time a bit differently.
I think what's special is that I still have what I made when I was 23. I talk to artists whose parents like threw out their artwork or things like that. I think the amazing thing is not my age. I think it's my persistence. I've always been really serious about like being in this world, and making these photographs is an act of like self-determination. It's really activism. I think just, you know, I told someone yesterday, like in terms of activism, I'm like, I'm Black and I woke up alive. That's activism enough for me, you know? But what I make a photograph of has to be readable 50 years from that moment. So I think that was a consideration, like, you know, where's this going to show up? Either nowhere or somewhere. And I'm still trying to make that somewhere happen. And now it's truly history. When I look at it, I'm just amazed at the history that I've witnessed.
So we're just about at the end of our regional journey through Black photojournalism in the mid-20th century, which is why I feel it's incumbent on me to say that when it comes to Black photojournalism, we've only just scratched the surface. Think of all the unseen photographs out there in the Afro's archives, in Ernest Withers' archive, in the Charles Tini Harris Archive at Carnegie Museum of Art. Think of all the discoveries still to be made. The work of sharing and preserving these images, these artworks, these stories is ongoing. It's work that relies on dedicated archivists, curators, and artists, but also on people like you, maintaining an interest in these photographers and their work. We must understand the ways in which they saw history and made history. And we must keep finding new ways to keep their legacies alive. For a closing thought, here's Andrew Cowens again.
We know our people better than anybody else. That's what I think. And so we show certain sides of us that can only be done by us, you see. It's just like when you're in a Baptist church and the priest is going, and God said so and so and so, and everybody says amen. Well, you know, people say, well, why they say amen? It's called call and response. It's like you sit in a jazz club and a guy finishes a great solo and everybody claps. Everybody together. It's not, okay, people, it's time for you to clap. No, the emotion is such that it makes you want to clap. That person that's played a line or a solo that's just so beautiful that you have to jump up and clap. Or you have to say something, and that's what it's all about. For me, anyway.
Thank you, Ming Smith, Andrew Cowens, Anthony Barboza, Sean Walker, and Marilyn Nance. Thank you, Charlene Foggy Barnett and Dan Lears at Carnegie Museum of Art, and our executive producer, Rachel Wolf of Sand and Wolf, Inc. I also want to thank everyone who's listening for joining us on this exploration. One last time, Black Photojournalism is a production of Carnegie Museum of Art, Pittsburgh. For more information on this podcast and the Black Photojournalism exhibition, please visit carnegieart.org.